Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer Distributors. For more information, visit unionbeerdist.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. Today is Tuesday, October 17th, 2017. We have a special guest joining us today, all the way from London, beer writer Pete Brown.
Hello.
How are you, Pete? All right, listen to that. All right.
I didn't realize there were that many people in here.
You know, it's a live studio, man. And we'll be talking about your new book, Miracle Brew.
Yeah.
So you're in town for that, and I know you've hit all the other radio shows, Ferment About It, Steal This Beer.
Absolutely, absolutely. I love doing radio. It's great. I've got a good face for radio, as the old joke goes. And I'm over here for about 10 days promoting the book. Really excited. This is my eighth book, and it's the first time I've had a North American publicity tour to do. And it's kind of like a dream come true for me. So
well,
thank
that's
you.
That's great. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And Jason Saylor, our ultimate New York State ingredient brewer at Strong Road Brewery.
How's it going?
Welcome,
Jimmy?
Man. Thanks. So Jason, it's Rye Week, New York.
Oh,
something
yeah.
new.
Yep. Yeah, we got a New York Rye Week mainly put it on by the distilleries and celebrating the new Empire rye whiskey that is being debuted this week. We as a New York State ingredient brewery, we've done some of our own rye stuff with the local grains, New York craft malt, Torochner, and Willett Hoppen grain. So we're trying to partake as much as possible and focus and show what's out there in terms of New York rye.
That's exciting. And Thursday we'll be at your place tasting some of your rye beers.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a little kind of rye takeover going on at the brewery. We have a rye Belgian strong from us, as well as a that features rye malt. We also have a stout that was aged in rye barrels, and then we're also showcasing a rye amber ale from Fifth Hammer.
Chris Kuzmi, all right.
Yeah, Mr. Kuzmi.
That's great.
So, yeah, it should be exciting. That starts at around 6 p.m., so on Thursday.
Well, it's a really great tie-in because, you know, it's rye week, you're making rye beers, and, you know, Pete, we're really going to talk about your book tonight, Miracle Brew, and, you know, you broke down beer into categories. So it's not, in the intro, I love it. You said most people in the old days thought beer was made of chemicals.
Yeah.
In a big factory.
Yeah. I find that, when I go around the place talking to people about beer and say, what is it made from? And people don't know. And it's bizarre. In fact, since the book was published just 2 weeks ago in the UK, there's a beer industry campaign called Beer for That. There's a Beer for That. And they did a survey, and they were asking people about ingredients and provenance. And no surprises, 88% of people said, it's very important to know what's in my food and drink, where it comes from, why it's there, additives, all that kind of thing. And then they said, cool, yeah, okay, so what are the ingredients of beer? And only 22% of people were able to name what's in beer. And the whole chemicals thing, you know, a lot of macro beer gets produced in big factories. And the book was really inspired by, one big macro brand in the UK that ran a campaign saying, by the way, you might think of, obviously not in these words, but you might think of us as a cheap, crappy lager, but we only brew using 100% British barley. And I saw that ad and went, oh, okay, I'm still not going to drink the beer, but I think more of it now than I used to. And the core ingredients, the big fans of that beer, started complaining to the brewery, saying, this beer doesn't taste as good now you've started putting grass in it. Can you go back to making it out of chemicals like you always used to? So big beer drinkers think that beer's made out of chemicals, and some of them are okay with that. I just thought that was a bit weird.
So you broke down your book. So Miracle Brew, hops, barley, water, and yeast. You break it down to the ingredients.
The four ingredients, yeah. And Miracle-
you really went deep on this. I mean, I yeah. honestly, I read the full malt chapter. I started the water chapter, and then that was it. So,
I mean,
but I'm going to read the whole book.
But my approach was to put aside everything I thought I knew about the ingredients. I've never really brewed myself, so I'm a commenter on the industry rather than a brewer. And I decided that I would put to one side everything I thought I knew, and I was right to do that because a lot of stuff that I thought I knew turned out to be wrong. And I was approaching it very logically, going, okay, so this is why we do this, and that's why that happens. And every time I had a question that or something in the reading that I didn't understand, I would go to a master brewer or two who I knew and ask them. And a few times in that chapter, they went, oh, I don't know. Never thought of it like that before. That's really interesting. So I realized that just by coming from a very logical, kind of naive approach, I was asking some questions that even brewers themselves didn't know.
That's great. And Jason, you know, I mean, let's start with the malt chapter. I mean, for you, you're doing things with malt and York ingredients that most other guys aren't.
Yeah. I mean, we're doing about 95% New York malt in all of our beers. We're, you know, really focused on working with the new kind of crop of malt houses that have popped up in the last 5 years. And, you know, we're really, most of what we're getting right now is the base grain for the beers. The specialties just aren't there yet in terms of what we're actually looking for our beers. But, you know, it's coming along. New roasters are coming online and they're going to be start playing around with them. And we'll, you know, kind of be the test bed for that, for those grains coming through and for all of the, you know, all of the, everything that's coming through New York. We're really trying to be kind of that go-to brewery, that place that, you know, utilizes these ingredients and tries to, you know, be that sounding board for them. You know, playing with new roasted grains, playing with new grain varieties. Maybe it's, you know, they're getting triticale or something else that's not a normal thing, and they're trying to see how it was. We talked to, you know, Ted Hawley at New York Craft Malt, and because there was no flaked corn in the state. There's plenty of corn in New York, but no flaked corn. So, and he just came through and there's going to be flaked corn now. So we can play around with that for our cream ale and stuff like that. So we're really trying to push it.
So Pete, you know, as you wrote the book, you know, trying to explain to people, you know, how beer is made, you know, Jason can talk about the new malt facilities and the specialty grains that are being grown in New York. But, you know, what is malt?
It's, I mean, this was going back to first principles for me, and the way I tried to understand it was, you know, to make any alcoholic drink, you need a source of fermentable sugar. And we know this, but thinking about it from a sort of abstract way, and fruit offers its fermentable sugars up very easily. Grain tries a lot harder to keep its sugars to itself. And so if we want to ferment something out of grain, we have to try much harder than if you try to ferment something out of fruit. Fruit, you just let it rot, and then the yeast does the job itself. Grain, we have to help the yeast. And the fascinating thing I thought about this was that we figured out how to activate the enzymes in grains to convert their starch to sugar about 8,000 years ago. We only discovered enzymes and what they were and what they did about 180 years ago. So somehow we were able to control and manipulate enzymes without even knowing what the hell they were or that they even existed. And that's what malting is. You know, you take barley, the sugar is stored in barley in a way that yeast cannot ferment it, and we trick the barley into surrendering its sugar so that yeast can go to work on it. And it's I think it's just such an incredible process, a miraculous process that we managed to figure out.
It still blows my mind. I mean, when, yeah, like, I you bring it up now, but I think about this fairly often. It's just like what these people went through and what they did when they first started, when this all started happening for the first time, is like, where did that even come from? Like, just the thought process and exactly. What was going on. It's still, yeah, it's awesome.
So there's this whole kind of origin story of beer that sounds like it makes sense, which is, oh, I guess some guys in the Levant thousands of years ago gathered some grain and they They left it out and it got wet, and so the grain was moist and the yeast came in and fermented it into beer, and someone said, oh no, the grain's turned into this mush. Oh, actually it tastes nice and it makes me feel good. And there have been experiments that show that that could not have happened. That definitely did not happen. The grain had to be malted before, even if it was an accident, the first ever brew, the grain would still have to have been malted before then for that to happen. So it's like, how long did it take people to figure that out, that you had to do that? Yeah. And what were they trying to do? And what were they thinking when they were kind of, okay, I guess maybe I'll lay it out flat and let it dry, and then I guess I'll wet it, and then I'll dry it again, and then I'll wet it again. And now that the seed rootlets coming through and shoots, okay, now I'll dry it. And how did, it must have taken thousands of years to figure out.
So the first beer, yeah. Still figuring that one out.
Yeah.
But the chapter on malt, I did read the whole thing, and you kind of took us through all that. I don't understand it. I mean, do you, Jason? I mean, I've seen, you know, we've been upstate Hudson Valley Malt, Dennis Niesel, and, you know, he's doing it the old way. He's shoveling the malt and doing small batches.
A couple of those.
And he's still learning how to do it.
Four malting processes. I understand it, you know, as much as, you know, kind of the next brewer, but it's, you know, it's, there's a lot to it. And, you know, especially for the New York, you know, growers, it's a revitalized process. So people are starting to figure out how it has to work here. You know, it works different ways, and you know, I mean, the malting process is the same, but our grains are different than the grains grown in Canada or England or anywhere.
This is a really interesting point that I came across talking to maltsters, is that for a long time, because malting, you know, the way you kiln a malt has such a dramatic effect on the flavour, you know, from a lager malt through to a chocolate or a coffee malt for a really dark beer. There's this assumption that the malting gives you all of the character, and that the grain itself doesn't really matter. And what you're proving, and what other people have shown, is that actually where the grain is grown and the variety and the way it's kept and the quality of the grain makes a huge difference before you even get to the malting.
Yeah. I mean, because the maltsters are one part of the process. You know, there's the farmers, the maltsters, and the brewers. Without great malt, we can't make good beer or great beer. Without great grain, the maltster can't make great malt. And so, you know, what we've done here in New York is since there was no brewing malt for forever, for a long time, we've had to figure out what varieties work, and some varieties just don't. Whether it's, you know, susceptible to pests or mold or downy mildew, or not downy mildew, sorry, you know, Fusarium head blight and all these different things. I mean, I was talking about the hops as well, but the malt, like all these things, does it have too much protein? Is it this? Because most of these grain farmers have been commodity farmers. They've been growing feed for cattle or whatever, or it's something that is just, they were trying to bulk it up.
Yeah.
And now cover crops.
Yeah. Cover. Like, so now it's like, okay, we're actually making, like, we're supposed to make really good seed so that it can then be malted. So they're now having to relearn processes and all this stuff and figure out, okay, this variety works, this variety doesn't.
And also all those things you're talking about, which a farmer and a maltster has to take into account, changes depending on where you are.
Right.
So the first ever named variety in the UK was a barley called Chevalier, and it grew in Norfolk. And Norfolk's got great terroir for malting barley. And everyone went, oh, the Chevalier barley's great. It's brilliant. Okay, let's plant it all over the UK. And when it was planted everywhere else, it was awful. It didn't work at all, because you're planting it in different soil.
Yeah.
The sunlight, the rainfall was all different. The ambient temperature was different. And it was perfect because it was grown in that one particular place.
Yeah. And that's a huge, I mean, in New York State, you've
Cheers.
Got...
Cheers.
Cheers.
Jason, just to jump in. So now talking about malts, you know, tell us about this beer.
Yeah, so this is Erie to Hudson. This is our version of a New York ESB. We use pale malt with a little bit of a caramel malt, a couple different caramel malts, and a touch of roasted barley, just to kind of give this back end character to it. You know, some pretty simple hops, you know, ferment it, you know, nice and, you know, 68 to 70, kind of stress our, or get our Scottish ale yeast, strain to kind of give some, esters. But yeah, just trying to go for, something that is reminiscent, not exactly the same, because it's not going to be exactly the same. We're not going to create a true ESB, but we're trying to go for something that's reminiscent and something that we could at least kind of put in that plane. You know, it's just about, it's a little, on the higher end, it's about 5.5%. But just a nice balanced malty, good bitterness, but not aggressive in any character.
It's got those levels of flavor to it that you can detect from the different malts. Potentially, each of the different malts that you described could have been the same variety of barley before it got to the maltster.
Oh, yeah.
And then, so then the way the maltster's treated that malt, it's like, okay, here's your pale malt, here's your chocolate malt, here's your whatever. And you can taste the layers of cool. the different varieties that are in there. It just gives it that depth and depth and depth.
Thanks.
It's great, man. We're off to a great start here. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Cheers.
In 1996, Sheehan Family Companies, formerly L. Knife & Son, acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn. Union Beer has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. It has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Brooklyn and parts of Queens through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten Island, and Long Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education at all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the seven counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit unionbeerdist.com. Whiskey
and wine. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, we got Pete Brown. His new book's out, Miracle Brew. I'm a big fan of Pete Brown. He's my favorite English beer and cider writer.
Thank you very much.
I carried around your cider book for a few years every time I met a cider maker. So we're talking about Jason's beer, ESB. So is ESB a style, Pete?
It is now, but in the UK, it's. I mean, this is what I love about beer and the way beer develops. ESB is the name of a beer that was brewed by Fuller's in London. It's Fuller's Extra Special Bitter. It was just, you know, the name they gave this one beer. And it's such a good beer that American brewers looking to emulate British beer styles basically brewed versions of it and expanded it and turned it into a style. And I can't remember which awards, I think it might have been the World Beer Awards. And when they came up with the style guidelines for ESB, they based it on Fuller's, because Fuller's is the ESB, you know, it's arguably the only real ESB. And when Fuller's entered Fuller's ESB to the same competition 2 years later, their beer was rejected for being not to style.
Things change. So on that note, like you, in your book, you talk about the heyday of pale ale, and you're referencing colors and malts. You know, what was the heyday of pale ale, and what was that pale ale?
Well, I always like to try and tie things back to the context in which we drink. I'm not a great technical expert on beer and brewing, I have to admit. But for me, it's all about why things happened and who was drinking and what was going on. And what you get with pale ale is... it became popular. It became popular thanks to technology, allowing us to kind of have greater control over the malting process, so you could produce these paler malts. And just as those beers were being perfected, glass became cheap and affordable. for people to use. And so suddenly we were drinking out of glassware instead of pewter tankards, and we could see what we were drinking. And at that point, beers like porter, which was the big, strong, hugely popular beer before Pale Ale came along, people were adding all sorts of crap to porter, and because you couldn't see it, you didn't know. People would add iron filings to it to give it a head. They would add poison to it to give it bitterness in low doses. I've got a book from 1818 which lists all the different things that people were putting into beer. And suddenly you got pale ale in a glass and you can see literally what's in the beer. And it became very fashionable. And this was at the height of the British Empire, the height of Queen Victoria's reign, the Great Exhibition of 1851. Britain was on top of the world. And in Burton-on-Trent, we'd created this beautiful pale ale, which somehow tasted better than pale ale brewed anywhere else. And it conquered the world. It was, you know, Bass Pale Ale was the world's first ever multinational brand. Hmm. And it was propagated by the East India Company, the world's first global corporation. And Britain literally ruled the world, and that was the taste of it. It was kind of an accident of different things coming together, really.
So let's go. The next chapter in your book is about water. You mentioned Burton-on-Trent. Give us an overview of water. You said that really what's in our glass is only water.
Yeah, we talk about there's an ad for for Miller Lite at the moment that's talking about the ingredients of beer. It said this beer contains, you know, malt and rice and whatever, hops and stuff. And I tried to... it's a confusing sort of rabbit hole to go down. Because beer, the things that beer is made of is not the same as the things that's in your glass. So we say beer's made of hops and barley. Well, yes, it is. But there's no hops and barley in this glass. There are compounds extracted from hops. There are flavour compounds extracted from barley. There may be some residual yeast in here, but usually we get flavour compounds and alcohol that the yeast has created. But really what you've got in your glass is 95, 96% water and about, you know, 5% alcohol. And that's it. So water is the only ingredient that's still in the glass when it's a finished beer, if that makes any sense.
Did you ever think of it that way, Jason?
I mean, water is a huge component. And thankfully here in New York, we have great water coming from upstate and the reservoirs up there. So we don't have to, in New York, you have a very kind of baseline water that you don't have to manipulate if you don't want to. You can, if you want to, you can add salts and gypsum and all these other things to, maybe mimic the water of Burton-on-Trent or, of Pilsen and like other Munich or something like that. Some place that has like London water, like you can try to mimic these things by building and taking away and manipulating the water. For us, we are very much, using New York ingredients. We're very much, okay, let's utilize our water and let's see what we're getting out of this, and let's bring that into the beer and make that part of the showcase of our beers I have.
So what styles work best with, if you just don't treat New York water at all, what kind of styles does it favor?
I mean, lighter beers, like you can have a very crisp, clean beer. It's a very soft water. There's not a lot of minerals. But for us, we do a little bit of everything, and we've found success from everything. From our we've been doing a little bit more manipulation of water recently for our lighter beers, but our stouts do really well. I think it just depends on for me, I think that it's a blank slate, and you can do really well with it. You might just want to accent certain things and do certain things here and there to kind of raise it up just a little bit.
Pete, so again, in your book, so the two areas that are interesting, Burton-on-Trent water and the water in Pilsen, Czech. Give us a little overview.
They're the two counterpoints to me. They're kind of the opposites. So, if we think of water as just water, it's obviously not. And I think the romance of this for me is that when water falls as rain, it is H2O with a little bit of carbonic acid. And by the time water is pulled from a well or a spring or an aquifer, it's no longer that. It has pH, it has hardness or softness, and it has mineral ions within it. And they all come from the land through which, you know, the waterfalls as rain flows through that land and is pulled out. So water for me is the ultimate terroir ingredient. And I describe it in the book as land taste. And literally, the brewing water you get is the taste of the land. And so it varies massively depending on the soil type and the geology of where you are. So the geology in Pilsen in the Czech Republic produces incredibly soft water, which takes on almost nothing from the land around it, and is just, as you say, it's a blank slate on which you can brew beautiful lagers. The water in Burton-on-Trent is full of minerals, especially gypsum, calcium sulfate. If you try and brew a Pilsen lager with Burton water, the hop bitterness would be incredibly harsh and astringent. It would be a really unpleasant drink. If you try to bring a Burton Pale Ale in Pilsen, it's going to not taste right. It's going to be kind of bland and stuff. So you brew a pale ale, a hoppy pale ale with Burton water, and it's bright and the hops stand out and the bitterness is rounded. And the water's doing all that. And that's why Burton had this reputation for the best pale ale in the world. And for a long time, they had no idea. They just thought, there's something about this place where we brew pale ale here. It just works better.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in that because water is the biggest component, and it's so important. All this important, and yet it you know, we as a society, not necessarily brewers, treat our water horribly.
Yeah.
So many times it's thrown in and we can't use, I mean, you know, down here we're in brackish water and so you wouldn't necessarily be able to use that anyways.
No.
But it's just, people just like don't think about it. And this then like, you know, it's
Pete, what about you? You said that. So based on the success of Bass Ale, Burton-on-Trent, people start Burtonization of water.
Yeah, I mean, before that happened, and it's kind of a sad story in a way. Not really, not for the beer drinker, but certainly for Burton-on-Trent, it's a sad story. But Burton became the centre of brewing science, the global centre of brewing science, and what those brewing scientists did was try to pinpoint what made Burton so special. And in the end, in the 19th century, they said, we've cracked it. It's the minerality of the water. And here's the mineral composition of Burton water. Now, at this point, London brewers who wanted to brew pale ale could not brew that pale ale in London. They had to open satellite breweries in Burton-on-Trent, 140 miles away, and then ship their beers back from Burton to London. And as soon as the properties of Burton water were identified, in London they could just add those salts to their water and recreate Burton water anywhere in the world. And when that happened, all the brewers in Burton-on-Trent just disappeared, just closed down. And Burton's now this strange donut-shaped town with kind of a mall in the middle with a huge car park where all the breweries used to be, and then houses and shops around it. And it's just kind of a very sad, faded town. And it's ironic for me that I talk to brewers in the United States and they're like, oh man, you know, I make my IPA, I Burtonize my water. I would love to go to Burton-on-Trent and see the home of this famous water. You really don't want to. I'm sorry. I'm a passionate defender of Burton, but I've seen people turn up at Burton ready to go, okay, I'm in the home of pale ale, show me the sights. And you do, and they're like, oh, I'm just wasting that money.
And does Burtonization mean anything to you?
Yeah, I mean, I understand it as a concept, and you know, for us, we're not Burtonizing any of our water. We're not, you know, Londonizing. We're not changing the water to meet any specific, you know, city or
that kind of missed the point of what you're doing, wouldn't it?
Right. So you know, we'll adjust it every once in a while just to kind of accent some things, but we're, you know, excuse me, really not kind of playing with it too much, because I do want to see what, you know, New York water is and how that makes a New York beer, you know, and then, you know, go from there.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, it seems in your chapter, though, you do end up leaning towards the idea of not tampering with the water and trying to create a local style of beer.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on where you are. This is why I'm really interested in what you're doing, because you can't go against what your water tells you, and your local water will influence the beer styles that work or don't work in the area where you're brewing. And, you know, Pilsen Water gave us Pilsner Lager. Burton Water gave us India Pale Ale. You know, what's New York Water going to give us? Maybe there's a beer style that works with the water profile here that works better than anywhere else.
Right. And that's and it's kind of one of the things I've wanted to try to push. Not that we'll ever create anything new or unique, but to create something that is of the place and part of where we're from. It, you know, so many people do adjust the water to replicate certain things that it's, you know, I want people to, you know, not just us, but other places to really utilize those waters and ingredients, local ingredients to hopefully, you know, further the beer landscape.
You know, and Jason, in New York, Pete, in the 19th century, New York State was one of the great hop centers in the country.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of breweries in New York City. Was there a typical style that was being made in New York City then?
Oh man, that's
Jason's question.
Oh, shoot. I don't know.
Brooklyn.
And I'm not gonna be able to answer that one. I wish I could. Sorry. I don't know that.
That's your homework.
Yeah, that's
then
my
we'll
homework.
Come, Thursday that's night will be at Strong Road Brewery for the rye beer tasting.
I'll tell you all about it Thursday.
Yeah. Yeah. And talking about your book tour, Pete. So you've already been on Ferment about it, our friend's show, yeah. Your Steal This Beer. You know, what else is on your tour? You must be having some fun.
Yeah, so tomorrow I'm going to Boston, and I'm spending a bit of time there, going up into Vermont, heading to Hill Farmstead, and then I'm going from there to Toronto. There's a Cascades Festival on Saturday in Toronto, I think the biggest Cascale Festival outside the UK, so that's going to be interesting. Another bit of stuff there.
You'll probably see Steve Beaumont, right?
Yes.
You know Steve,
yes.
Yeah?
Steve and I will be doing a book signing together on the Saturday afternoon. Then an event with Henderson Brewing in Toronto on Sunday, then back to Boston, a bit more stuff there, and then back home next Tuesday.
Are there any of the Boston breweries that you're dying to try the beer or you're big fans of?
I mean, I'm not able to keep up to date with what's new and what's happening, but I've been writing about beer for 15 years, so you know, I think whenever you come into a scene, whether it's music or beer or whatever, your early preferences are fixed. You know, and so for me, and it might not be the sort of hippest names to drop now, but you know, brewers like Sam Adams and Harpoon helped shape the beer universe for me. They may have been superseded by small and more nimbler, more experimental brewers now, but for me, they're still the big names. You know, and I'm very excited to go and see them.
Jason, what are some Boston breweries that he should check out?
Boston,
Trillium.
Trillium and...
Oh, of course, I didn't realize they were there.
Night Owl, I think, yeah.
Go north of Boston, Notch Brewing.
Notch,
he's doing a lot of Czech-style beers.
I haven't done too much Boston stuff. I don't know. I haven't even tried Trillium that much, so...
Mystic Brewing.
And tomorrow night, I'm doing an event with Aeronaut Brewing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yes. In Somerville, Mass.
I'm very excited about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We did a show there a couple years ago. That would be fun. All right. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
Like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, check us out, heritageradionetwork.org. Become a member. There's a lot of member perks, and the holidays are coming up, so there'll be some membership drives, but there's so many great shows. In fact, Ferment About It, the other beer show, had Pete on yesterday, so cheers to them. Cheers to Mary and Chris. So, Jason, this next beer we're drinking.
Yeah. So this is our rye week. This is our rye strong Belgian ale, 7%. You know, just we've just started kind of playing around with the yeast character. We were very much focused on Scottish ale yeast strain for all of our beers, and we've just introduced the Saison yeast strain. So this is our first kind of Belgian strong ale that has about 13% rye in it. New York rye, all New York beer. Yeah, just, you know, a lot of like Belgian characters, you know, that nice kind of banana and a little bit of a clove and just a nice kind of, you know, sweet malt character. The rye comes through a little spicy, peppery.
So Jason, since it's a Belgian style, then that we can talk about yeast, right? The next chapter.
It's all, yeah.
Why is that? Everyone's like, we had two other beers. We talked about water and malt. And now because it's Belgian, we're going to talk about yeast.
Yeah, it's I think all of us who are into beer now, kind of post Michael Jackson, and the work that he did in popularizing Belgian beer, we just kind of take for granted that Belgian beer is more eccentric. It went on a different path than beer did in the rest of the world, and I never really knew why, and I never really asked why, I never really thought about why, and then I had to address that for this book, and it goes back to the work that Louis Pasteur and Emil Hansen at Carlsberg did in the 1870s and 1880s to isolate single-strain yeasts. And that was a massive innovation in the history of brewing, because once you had... I hate saying the word control, because no one controls yeast. Yeast does what the hell it likes. But once we understood yeast and we could kind of breed it in laboratory conditions and get the same yeast and pitch exactly the same yeast again and again and again... suddenly a brewer could create beers where all the flavours in the beer were flavours that they had designed and put there. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a random element that the yeast could have introduced. And that was great for big mainstream brewing. This is what gave birth to macro brewing, basically. But you had to have big investment to get the equipment that Pasteur and Hansen were using, which meant you had to have big urbanised target audiences. And so in London, in New York, big brewers could kind of do that. Now, Belgian brewing was much more rural. And the Belgians said, well, we can't afford this big equipment. We can't afford to do these kind of... So we'll deliberately... And it was the Trappist monasteries who led this charge, said, we'll go the other way and deliberately create a Belgian style which is not about cleanliness and precision and repeatability, that retains this kind of countryside wildness to
it. So that was a conscious decision on their part.
Absolutely. This is the earliest, it's about 100 years ago. The Trappist said, we need to decide quick what Belgian beer is, because Heineken's over the border churning out this stuff that everyone's going crazy for. Carlsberg's up the road doing the same thing. We're going to be crushed by them because we can't emulate them. So we need to do something different. And that's where this Belgian spicy wildness comes from. It was a deliberate attempt to preserve those traditions rather than use industry to ride over them.
That's a great explanation. Yeah. Cheers, man. Cheers. Now I get it.
I knew that. I learned all that about a year ago. So,
and then, Jason, what did you just pour, an Allagash?
Yeah, we just poured Allagash triple. Yeah,
So how does the triple fit into your explanation of the Belgian yeast?
So it's got that kind of spiciness. It retains that. I mean, this is not for me the defining thing about a triple, but it does have something. What you get with, I guess just to continue the previous point, is what you get with the lager is you want the yeast to ferment the sugar into alcohol. And you want the yeast to have a fairly minimal contribution to flavour. You know, the yeast is there doing two jobs. Fermentation creates flavour compounds and it creates alcohol. You know, and a Heineken or a Carlsberg yeast is having minimal flavour impact. And a Belgian yeast is doing a lot of flavour stuff as well. So you mentioned the kind of, on the last beer, the sort of clovey and banana-y notes. I never realised again until I started researching this book, but that those notes were created by the yeast.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I was really surprised to learn that.
Yeah, yeah. Just I mean, depending on how you know, depending on the yeast strain, depending on temperature, depending on pitching rates, depending on so many you know variables, and you can really stress certain things and pull back on others. That's what I mean, you know, to go back to your original question, that's why when people talk about yeast, that they go to the Belgians, because it's the most expressive out of all of the strains that we're dealing with. So it's a great way to play and learn about it.
This is why I keep coming back to Belgian beer. You know, I go off on flights of fancy where I want more and more hops, or I want more and more sour, or this, that, and the other. But at the end of the day, you always come back to Belgian styles because they have these exotic elements, but they're all held in balance with each other. And the things that you get from the yeast go perfectly well and are enhanced by and enhance in turn what you're getting from the malt. And you know, the hops are playing a role, but that's much more muted in the whole balance of things. And I just love the balance that you get in Belgian beers.
Interesting. Okay.
I think for a lot of people, balance is a dirty word at the moment. We want extreme. We want big.
Or sour.
But sour and big and hop, it can also be balanced. You know, if you think about... I show my age when I talk about this because I say, like, you know, think about a big Wi-Fi system with a graphic equalizer. And millions go, what is a graphic equalizer? But when you've got all these dials kind of controlling the nature of the sound that's coming out of your music system, they can be in balance and all down low at the bottom. Yeah. And they can be in balance all at the top as well. You know, balance doesn't mean bland. It just means that everything's working together.
That's across all. I mean, yeah, we for what we try to do at Stronger, we try to create, try to balanced beers. Sometimes say we do like no frills beers. It's, you know, we try to create this really nice kind of cohesion between the malt, the hops, the water, the yeast, all of this stuff kind of coming together so that we're creating these just unique beers for the region, for what we're doing, but just really just drinkable and nice and easy. We do play around and push the hops. We do play around and push the malts sometimes, but, you know, for the majority of it, I just, you know, I want something that I can just drink, you know, go to a pub and drink a pint, you know, a bunch of pints. Like that's what I want. And that's what I try to strive for in most of our beers. Balance is key.
Yeah. Yeah. And all those four ingredients all have a role to play. Yeah. I think that's what really came out of this book for me, is that each one of them is doing some heavy lifting. And we just think it's hops, and it's not. It's all four.
Well, let's go to hops. There's, I know Justin brought in a bunch of samples. There's a, Jack's Abbey House Lager. Nah. Jason's going for one of those funky cans. You know, all these cans have the same, it's like the same artist does them. It's like street art on a can. And I'm like, what brewery is that from?
This is a Half Acre.
Half Acre.
Tuna Extra Pale.
Which is actually one of my favorite American breweries right now.
That's a brave move, calling a pale ale tuna, in terms of what I'm about to expect from the flavor of it.
I've had this beer described as an ESB, talking about ESBs.
ESB or ESP? It's extra.
Is it ESP?
Or it's or what do they call it?
Anyways, Half Acre tuna. Extra, so on the nose, there's the
extra
hop.
Pale ale.
This is like the new American hop beer. EPA. Maybe it's a pale ale, extra pale ale. That I like a lot. That's kind of been my go-to style this year. I'm glad. Thank you, Justin, for bringing this. I wanted Pete to try this. But this is like the quintessential now beer of, you know, New York to me.
Yeah.
That's interesting to hear. I love coming over here because my first beer trip to America was the first time I tasted what we would now all think of as an IPA. And it blew my mind. It was like the first time I tasted an authentic Indian curry. I felt like up to now I've been tasting in black and white, and now I'm tasting in color.
So what was it?
Do you know what? The brand is not what it used to be. It was Bridgeport Pale Ale out of Portland, Oregon. And I went back there last year and it broke my heart. But moving on from that. But, you know, and it, also our palates move on and our expectations move on. And what was mind-blowingly hoppy 10, 15 years ago is not anymore.
Not even 10, 15 years. I mean, five years, the hop landscape has completely changed. You know, so much of what's going on in the current, you know, trends of IPAs is the juicy New England or Northeast style stuff. It's just, and you know, there's again becoming a divide. So some people love it, some people hate it. There's factions, and it's crazy, and it's really cool and a really interesting time right now for, you know, U.S. I mean, not even U.S. It's all over.
All over.
I went to Brazil, and I the first beer I had in Brazil like a couple months ago was a New England style IPA from one of the breweries down there. Mm. It's crazy.
But the first time I've seriously considered resigning as a beer writer was a few weeks ago.
When you got the review that I'm writing?
Was when someone described, someone separated IPAs into New England IPA and old school IPA. And I just thought, oh, I don't want to be part of this anymore.
Well, you know, moving a little bit forward from that, like what I like is like this beer, the Half Acre beer. I've been drinking Half Acre for months, loving it. That, you know, certain that new hoppiness has been what I've been drinking. Hmm. Today, starting with your beer, Strong Rope, the more balance, you know, ESB, pale ale type, and then going to Allagash Triple, my whole palate's reset. And yeah, and this hoppy beer just doesn't taste the same. And no. I actually want to go back to that Allagash Triple right now. Mm. So have you thought about that, how your palate changes and how we perceive, you know, these different flavors, you know, based on our expectations and you know, what we're used to?
Yeah, I mean, it changes all the time, doesn't it? And these dramatic kind of flourishes that can wow you one day just don't the next. And to kind of slightly take your question in a slightly different way, I spend a lot of time thinking about context, because we've all had that thing where, you know, so I spent last night, yesterday evening at Brooklyn Brewery, when Garrett Oliver presents one of his experimental Black Ops beers and talks you through it, you can taste every single nuance and
he's got the gift.
Flick to it when he's talking you through it. Now, I could take that same bottle of beer home, sit in front of the TV, pour it into a glass, and even though I'm trying to focus on everything that I remember Garrett saying, I can no longer taste the stuff that was there when he said it. And I've read stuff about how, you know, your palate is fresher in the morning. So whenever I'm judging a beer competition, we start tasting at 9:30 a.m. because if you're tasting at 4:30 p.m., you're not tasting the same stuff. Your palate's and it's difficult when you go across different styles like we've been doing now, that everything you've had before influences yeah. your perception of the flavor you've got right in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, also, I mean, ideally we'd be pouring, you know, washing each glass and stuff, but you know, yeah, it's
Thursday night at Strong Rope.
Yeah, we'll wash every glass.
And for me, it's about progressions. Like if I'm having a night of drinking, which is often, you know, I'll usually start with something lighter. But then near the end, I want like the bigger IPA yeah. or a bigger Belgian beer to finish me off.
The worst. Well, it's a high quality problem. Let's be honest. But the problem I sometimes end up getting stuck with is you go into a bar and you see a lot of these big beers with big flavors, and you think, okay, I'm going to stay here until 10:30, and that beer there is the one I'm going to finish on. Yeah. So I'm now going to work my way up to that beer, working back from that beer. And so you get the big 10:30 beer, you go, yep, that was well planned, this is good. And then your friend bursts into the bar and says, hey, I've just won this amazing award for my beer, the drinks are on me. And you're like, damn it, I'm already on the big guys. Where do I go from here? I've got another 2 hours of drinking ahead of me.
Last thing, I love British beer culture. I love the way I've so many listeners and friends who are from England are able to talk about beer in a way that Americans don't. You want to say anything about that?
That's interesting that you say that. I'd be curious.
It's like your pint is your national pastime or something.
Yeah, yeah. Because I see it the other way, of course. And you're right, we talk about it in different ways. I find the American way of talking about beer incredibly analytical. And we have to categorize everything. We have to have, okay, we've got ABV, right, now let's have IBU, now let's have, you know, and what other scales can we come up with to describe this beer and to categorize and define it? We were having a conversation yesterday about session beer. And, you know, over here you've got this big struggle to define what is a session beer. We need to define it in terms of style and ABV. Now, the whole concept of a session beer is come out of the British pub and the way people drink in Britain. Now, we go for a session. No one in Britain has ever felt the need to define what a session beer is. It's just a beer that you can have a few pints of. It's a beer that when you finish one pint, you want another one. And that's it. We have got this thing about, you know, you go to drink 4 or 5 pints of beer in order to be in the pub, in order to be with your friends. Yeah. And that's what beer does. That's what beer facilitates.
And then another question, pub closing hours. You know, in New York, we're lucky. Many bars can stay open until 4 a.m. Man,
yeah, I love that. I absolutely, not that I'm there at 4, but just the fact that you can is just wonderful.
But what time do pubs close in London?
Well, this is 10 years ago now. We had a new licensing act. Pubs used to have to close at 11 p.m. And the reason they had to close at 11 p.m. in 2005 was so that the munition workers in World War One would turn up for work the following morning. So, you know, it's like maybe the regulations are overdue a kind of review, perhaps, just saying.
And then they loosen it up?
They loosened it up. What's happened is the vast majority of pubs have continued to close at 11. Some pubs stay open a bit later. Someone aggregated it all and worked out the average. So since pubs have been able to potentially stay open for as long as they want, on average, pubs stay open 20 minutes longer than they used to. Because we've got into that habit. That's the thing. The worst thing about it is that when pubs closed at 11, there was this whole ritual of at 10 to 11, the pub rang for last orders. So everyone surged to the bar, get their last drink in. If it's Friday night, your last two drinks. And then everyone gets thrown out on the street at the same time, and it's total carnage and chaos. And then the bell goes at 11, and that's it. You're done. And paradoxically, since the licensing hours have been relaxed, and you're thinking, well, you know, I don't have to rush to the bar to get my pint because I can sit here drinking, and we can go home when we want, they've stopped doing the ringing the bell thing. And so you're sitting there in a pub at 10 to 11, gets to 11 o'clock, 5 past 11, thinking, I'll just go and get one more. And they go, no, we're closed. It's like, well, why didn't you ring the damn bell? You know, the irony is that when you used to ring the bell, we all knew that we had to get for the last drink at 10 to and that you were closing at 11. Now we don't know what time you close. You're not telling us. You're not ringing the bell anymore. So it's gone a little bit weird.
Well, cheers, man. A little bit of dose cheers. Of Pete Brown. I'm really... proud to meet you again, beer and cider writer. It's next week, Cider Week New York, and you know, we'll be doing a lot of cider shows as well. But thanks so much for coming on. You want to say anything else about you got your book tour, Boston, Toronto?
Just please buy it. let's cut to the chase. I'm really, really proud of this book. It's my fourth book specifically about beer. I've written, what I love about beer is it's so universal and so omnipresent that as a non-fiction writer, which is what I consider myself, you know, I've written travel books about beer, I've written history books about beer, now I'm writing a nature book about beer, and I really want it to be appreciated in that vein, and I'm hugely
you use a term for the four beer ingredients at the beginning of your book. Like weeds and...
Oh, yes.
What do you say?
Beer is made from grass, weeds, fungus, and water.
Yeah, I love that.
That's basically what it is.
And Jason, last plug for your Rye Week event.
Yeah, come out Thursday to the brewery, 6 p.m. We'll have three rye beers and really showcase what New York Rye is all about.
And that's a whole other show talking about, you know, what some brewers are resistant to using rye. But it's a great New York grain. So
yeah, totally.
That's something for next time. A couple of shout-outs. Again, with Rye Week, our good friends at New York Distilling are hosting the majority of the events this weekend, ryeweek.com, including a big pig roast on Sunday. If you want a $5 off discount, you can use the Jimmy Pick code at ryeweek.com. And our event for Cider Week is next week, Cider Feast, October 28th at the Brooklyn Kitchen. Go to jimmysnumber43.com. We've got some great cider makers, including Tom Oliver from UK, Steve Wood, a bunch of others coming in that night. In closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to Pete and Jason for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to our producer, Justin Kennedy, and engineer, David Tadashore. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Woo. Cheers.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.